But I mean, the bottom line is.
Yeah.
Just FYI.
Yeah, I think they're all the
chairs and trying to come in.
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is Thursday, March 8th, 2012. And for the record, let the record show that we have quorum. First bill today is Senator Benson, Senate File 1675, regarding adoption and family service. Welcome to the committee, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I have Senate File 1675. If someone could move the A9 and A10 amendments for me.
Senator Benson, since this is not the primary jurisdiction of this committee, or this committee is not the primary jurisdiction, you will have to explain the A9 amendment and the A10, is it? Why don't we take A9 first?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The A9 amendment corrects language. There is no sheriff's department. There is a sheriff's office with regard to the safe place for newborns. We added the clarification during hours of operation. And clarification that a safe place that is not a hospital must arrange to transport the newborn by calling 911 or requesting ambulance service. Further clarification that the hospital must inform a local welfare agency within 24 hours of receiving a newborn. Again, technical amendment, removing the word hospital, replacing it with safe place, a clarification. Technical cross-reference, and again, reminding, clarifying in statute that the newborn must be transported to a hospital, and removing a conflict in language regarding transport of a newborn to a hospital.
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A9 amendment.
Senator Newman moves the A9 amendment. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator
Thank
Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The A10 is just further cleanup, striking hospitals and inserting safe places, and clarifying the references to safe place.
Senator Newman moves the A10 amendment. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Please proceed, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I have with me today Ms. Christine Borsheim from the Department of Human Services. She has been helping me to shepherd this bill through the Health and Human Services Committee and will be assisting with the judiciary portion of Senate File 1675. I believe she's going to begin with a broad overview so that there's quite a bit of overlap among the committees, so it's a catch-up for those who aren't on HHS.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, thank you. I'm Christine Borsheim. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'll start out by letting you know that Senate File 1675 that we're seeing today actually builds on the work that was started last year in the department's bill, 1173. So many of you may have recalled that bill from last year. That bill was in regard to children in foster care and children under state guardianship and adoptions. This year's bill accomplishes further reforms to improve safety and permanency provisions for children and youth. Broadly, it expands protections under the Safe Place for Newborns Act. It provides for early identification, location, notifications, and involvement of non-custodial parents and relatives when children are in foster care. It provides for permanency progress review hearings for all children in foster care at 6 months to ensure that reunification efforts are on track and that backup permanency plans are in place when reunification doesn't occur. And it achieves conformity with federal provisions that include educational stability and educational planning, medical planning, credit reports for older youth, and relative search requirements. What's largely in this bill and under the jurisdiction of this committee is, for the most part, existing language that has moved references to adoptions of children under state guardianship, which are currently found in Chapter 259, out of that chapter into 260C, which is the Juvenile Court Act. This is done to lay out a more logical and legally sequential legal process for children from their entry into foster care through finalized adoption. It creates a single legal process for foster care and adoption, which will improve permanency outcomes for children and youth. It improves the transparency of this permanency process, having all of the legal process in one place, and it achieves administrative simplification. There are also sections in this bill that modify child support provisions and MFIP.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone else who wishes to give testimony on the bill? Anyone in the audience who wishes to say either for or against the bill? Well, hearing none, is there any discussion from members? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just kind of remember what the why we need this language. Just
Ms. Borchardt?
What is missing now from the system that we need? Or are we protecting children more with this language? Is that the impetus to it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Borchardt.
Yes, Senator Goodwin. Yes, I think although it's largely existing language, there are modifications to 259 and 260C, which clarify a lot of the legal processes. Like I said, there's been language added that strengthens our efforts to include relatives early in the process of foster care and throughout the proceedings. The major accomplishment, as I mentioned earlier, is really about putting all of the legal processes that deal with children in foster care and permanency in a single part of statute, which makes it easier to administer and really actually makes the whole process more transparent. In today's process, once a child has had a termination of parental rights, they've been in foster care, have gone through all the permanency proceedings, have a termination, then they go into an entire new legal process in the adoption process. So this makes it a more seamless process for them and their families.
Sarah Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I'm asking is because we've had, I hope it clears up this situation where we had an incident last couple years ago in my district where the children were taken away from the parents for very good reason, but they went with the grandparents. And then DHS was saying that they had to become foster parents or do something like that in order to keep them, and they didn't do it in a timely fashion, and they came and yanked the kids out of the grandparents' home and scared the heck out of the kids, and I don't know what all happened after that. It's not only one incident. There's been other similar incidences to that where so I'm really interested in the relative part where you, before children are placed with foster homes, that the department or the county find eligible relatives and reliable relatives that they can go with without being yanked out of the house, because that's happened a few times. So does this do anything in that area?
Ms. Borchardt.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the preferred placement for children would always be with their relatives. If they were to be taken away from relatives, it should be for some other reason that the children would not be safe there.
Thank you.
Any other discussion, Senator Harrington?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple questions. In your general, and this is on page 6 under 6.2, it has a reference here to a health care provider that provides access to urgent care services. And I'm just wondering, what does that mean in terms of urgent care? I'm thinking, is it like urgent care where you go in to just get your throat swabbed at a doctor's office, or is it something else?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, I think urgent care settings in this provision, although there has been some amendment to this now with the amendment that we offered today, we really would be those kind of settings that offer access to 24-hour types of care. So there might be urgent care freestanding clinics that are 24 hour, 7-day-a-week type of clinics. It would not be, you know, the clinic at Target or something like that. But like I said, I think that was also amended in the amendment that we offered.
Okay. Any further discussion? Sir Harrington.
Another question on the same page, a little further down. This is in regards to the whole issue about responders who take the child not making any inquiries as to the identity. And my question is, in reading this, it talks about, you know, provided that the newborn is unharmed when presented at the hospital, what level of scrutiny does that typically involve in terms of having taken a number of child abuse reports where later on I find out that the baby had a spiral fracture or had a skull fracture or had internal injuries that weren't necessarily apparent upon a visual observation of the child? I'm wondering how we know whether the child is unharmed whether it's not prudent at some point to have some identity taken. I'm a little bit concerned that we're going to end up with a child who's dropped off, who in fact does have injuries that were not easily detectable by visual observation, and that we will, from the police perspective or from human services perspective, be unable to do follow-up because we hadn't taken down the initial data.
Ms. Borsheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, being left unharmed is really kind of a visual check at that time. If the baby had been harmed, the entire nature of this changes into a criminal matter. A safe place for newborns would no longer apply.
Follow-up question?
Sure, Senator Harrington.
And I appreciate that it would change once you know that, but my read of this is that you're taking the baby based on a visual, you haven't done any further checks, and that once you've done that and the mom has left the scene, this will severely handicap the child abuse investigations or the Health and Human Services investigation or the police investigations into that. And I'm just wondering, how does that factor into this?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Borsheim.
Okay. Senator Harrington, I'd be reminded, actually, that this is actually current law. There's no change in this language. But I guess in response to that, at that point, someone has seen the person drop off the baby. But since it is in current language, it's not really part of today's discussion.
Okay. Nice. One more. And this is also maybe while we're in, I think this is part of the new piece on terms of relinquishing the newborn, but it talks about relinquishing the newborn to, after calling 911, to have an ambulance or emergency responder come. What did you have in mind in terms of the emergency responder? Are you looking at ambulance services typically, paramedic services, or are you looking at police or police or other parapolice professionals being able to do this?
Ms. Borsheim.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Harrington, I think over the conversation since this bill has been introduced, that the 911 dispatch would decide the most appropriate responder, and then most of the time that would be an ambulance.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the bill? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Hearing none, we need to have a motion. Senator Newman, would you...
Mr. Chairman, is this going to the floor?
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1675 be recommended to pass and go to the floor.
Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1675 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Next is Senator Newman. Senate File 2114. Child Support 20-Year Survival Judgments. Thank you. Senator Newman, anytime you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Newman, State Senator for District 18. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 2114 is an initiative from the Minnesota State Bar Association that I agreed to carry for them. I do not believe this is a controversial issue, and I would explain it very briefly, and then I have with me Mr. Brian Lake from the Bar Association that will explain it and answer any questions that you may have. But in a nutshell, in 2010, the DHS put a provision within their agency bill that would make child support judgment liens effective for a period of 20 years. And what you need to understand is that a judgment acts as a lien on real estate in any county where the judgment is docketed. Historically, judgment liens last for a period of 10 years. And so what would happen is if this provision were to be allowed to go forward, and I will tell you, as of right now, the law has not yet been implemented. What will happen is we wind up with a problem involving title to real estate in that title examiners, either on behalf of constituents who are having their title to their real estate examined for purposes of sale or for purposes of buying property, it becomes very difficult to tell whether or not a judgment lien is on the property because of the inconsistency of going from 10 years to 20 years on this one type of a judgment lien. It is my understanding that there has been an agreement that this provision can be repealed. And again, it is my understanding that this provision has not yet been implemented because of a delay in the effective date. And with that explanation, Mr. Chairman and members, I would ask that Mr. Brian Lake address any questions and make a few comments on the bill.
Mr. Lake, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Lake with the Minnesota State Bar Association. I think Senator Newman did an excellent job of explaining the bill. The core problem arose, as Senator Newman mentioned, during the 2010 session. There was a provision in the DHS bill that expanded the effectiveness of child support judgments from 10 years to 20.
Mr. Lake, could you pull the microphone a little closer to you?
Sure.
Thank you.
And as Senator Newman mentioned, the issue is really not related to child support. It's related to real estate. No one objects to the concept of 20-year liens for child support. It's the practical implementation of those that causes problems. And quite simply, all other land records are all their judgment liens, I'm sorry, are good for 10 years. And there is no indication in the court records whether a judgment lien is related to child support or not. So at the end of the 2010 session, we delayed the effective date of that law for a year, hoping that we could work out a solution with the other interested parties. We weren't able to get there. So last year, we again delayed the effective date. All the parties realized, I think, in the fall that there was really no way to do this, make this work, without a considerable amount of cost to the court system. And even then, it would still be some possibility for errors to be made or lack of clarity in land records. So all of the parties, including the Department of Human Services, have agreed that this idea is impossible to effectively implement. And this legislation does need to be passed this session because without it, that provision will take effect January 1st of 2013.
Thank you. And Senator Newman, do you have anyone else wishing to speak?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin Henschel has come to the testifying table, and I had not, until this very moment, I had not yet met him. Mr. Henschel is with Edina Realty Title, and he does have some comments that he would like to make.
And Mr. Henschel, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself
Yes.
for the record?
Mr. Chair, my name is Martin Henschel. I am Vice President of Edina Realty Title, but here really in my capacity as board member of the Minnesota Land Title Association.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you for having me. Really, I'm just here to say that the Minnesota Land Title Association has been working along with the Minnesota State Bar Association and the Department of Human Services over the last couple of years trying to figure out a way to get this situation where it could be implemented. We're not here speaking in for or against the public policy behind it. Behind the original bill, but just to say that because its implementation was going to be so difficult, it does make sense to pass this bill and repeal it until such time as in the future maybe they can figure out a way to implement it in such a fashion that it would not be cost prohibitive to search titles and know whether or not there's going to be judgment liens that extend out for 20 years. So we're here to support the bill.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Is there any discussion?
One quick question. You can count on me, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask about Article 2. It's the child care article in here. To amend the background study requirements and qualifying convictions for non-licensed family child care providers. That sounds, I'm sure, worse than it actually is. But
Senator Goodwin, are you referring to Senate File 2114?
Am I on the wrong bill, Mr. Chair?
You might be.
Okay. Let me see here.
All right.
I'm pretty sure Chairman, I can answer that one, Mr. Chair.
I hope she is.
Okay.
She's looking over the
yes, Mr.
The
Chair.
Correct.
I apologize.
Paper.
Sorry.
Is there anyone else that might have discussion, questions? Senator Goodwin, did you have any questions now?
Yeah.
All right. Hearing none, Senator Newman, could you make a motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate File 2114 be recommended to pass, move to the floor.
Senator Newman moves that Senate File number 2114 be recommended to pass and proceed to the floor. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Next on our list is Senator Fischbach.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
To the committee, Senator Fischbach.
Thank you very much. I do have an author's amendment. It's an oral author's amendment. If you would like to entertain that now, or
did you say it's an oral amendment?
Yes.
Why don't you give us a moment to catch up to our paperwork? Senate File 2148.
Okay.
Go ahead with your amendment, Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is on line 1.11 after the, I guess it's, I've written all over it, so I believe it's a semicolon. Remove the number two, close an existing fire, et cetera, all the way down to line 1.16. So in essence, what I would be looking at doing is removing the numbers 2 and 3, and then the additional language that refers to numbers 2 and 3.
Could counsel explain the amendment in a more formal manner?
Mr. Chair and members,
as
drafted, the bill prohibits local units of government from establishing new fire departments, closing existing fire departments, or withdrawing from an agreement to receive fire protection services from a fire department of another unit of government. The amendment would remove 2 of those 3 so that the bill would only prohibit local units of government from establishing a new fire department. Mr. Chair, in addition, you'd have to, on line 1.11, you'd have to delete the colon and the number 1.
And Mr. Backus, does that also include lines after the period on line 13 through
16,
Mr.
Chair.
1.16.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's what Senator Fischbach read.
All right.
The new paragraph B would then read just, unless approved by voters in an election described in paragraph D, a local unit of government may not establish a new fire department, period.
All right. Is that fairly self-explanatory to the members as an author's amendment?
And Mr. Chair, I am sorry, I did forget something. After a new fire department, it would be on line 1.11, just add until January 15th, 2012, or excuse me, 2013. And the reason I would want to add that is just to make sure that it is very clear that the moratorium is short, is temporary, it's short term until we can look at the standards.
What line was that that you
mentioned? That would be on 1.11, and it would be after the word department.
And could you restate that addition?
Until January 15th, 2013.
Until January.
So what it would read would be lines, I'll start over with 1.1. It would be B, unless approved by voters in an election described in paragraph D, a local unit of government may not establish a new fire department until January 15th, 2013.
Does everyone understand the oral amendment? Senator Ingerritsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I stepped out. But Mr. Backus, tell me what the first part of the amendment was. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingerritsen, basically the amendment would delete clauses 2 and 3 in that paragraph B, and then the sentence that follows it. So the only restriction would be on, the only prohibition would be on establishing a new fire department. And then there would be language that says, that makes it clear that the prohibition continues until only January 15, 2013.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Senator Fischbach moves the oral amendment. There was. That's right. You cannot
move it.
Senator Newman?
I'll move Senator Fischbach's oral amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. One question that did come up, Senator. Mr. Backus, could you explain how it affects the sunset provision?
Mr. Chair and members, you might have I would think you'd have the exact same effect as if you did not put the words until January 15, 2013 in paragraph B, and instead you changed the sunset date on line 2.4 to January 15, 2013, I think it'd have the same effect.
Mr. Chair, my understanding would be if you didn't put the until January 15th, 2013, then the sunset, it would be until June 1st, 2013. So, if you want to eliminate the language down there, that's fine. This is an author's amendment to put it in the form that I would like to have it heard.
Senator Fischbach, if we stayed with the original oral amendment that included the words on line 11 until January 15th, 2013, you're suggesting we also omit the language on page 2, lines 3 and 4?
If Mr. Chair, if that makes you more comfortable with the sunset amendment or the sunset language, then you would just have to remove on 2.4 and expires June 1, 2013, because you obviously want the effective date.
Council, can
Mr. Chair, members, I think you would want to do, you definitely would want to either delete or change the sunset date. I would think you would want to change the sunset date until January 15, 2013, because then the entire provision of law would expire. It's basically a temporary provision of law. You wouldn't want it to be on the books permanently.
Your tie looks like it's black. Mr. Chair, that's fine if you want to eliminate that.
So, Council, do we have to change the date on lines 2.4 to January 15th, scratching June 1st?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Right.
And then I think it would be up to the committee and the author if you wanted to also put the language about until January 15th, 2013 on line 1.11. I don't know that would be necessary, but it would be up to the committee.
Mr. Chair, that's fine. We'll just change that sunset date on 2.4 as part of the author's amendment.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Hearing no further discussion, Senator Newman renews his motion moving the oral amendment as previously described. Any other questions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, members, basically that Section B, I think that Mr. Backus even mentioned, it creates a short-term moratorium on new fire departments. Section C would require the state fire marshal to put together some suggested minimum standards on the creation of new fire departments. And there's a couple of suggestions there about what they should look at a minimum, the address staffing levels, equipment needs, and response times. And so that would come back to the legislature then on January 15th, 2013. And then in the final section in Section D, basically if a local government unit decides that they want to kind of override that moratorium, it would require an election in that local unit. I think there may be you know, a way we can make that language in that in D a little better. And we did add I did that author's amendment because we have been having discussions with the Minnesota State Fire Departments Association and the Minnesota Fire Chief Association so that they are more comfortable with that language. They were a little concerned about some of the language, so we're working on it. There's also maybe an issue of shared services, that there are departments right now in negotiations working on shared services. So I believe when we get to the local government committee, we'll be looking at an amendment. But I didn't want to attempt that today just because I'd like to work on that language. It might be a little finer point on the shared services, just so that we have that on the record, because I want everyone to understand we're going to be working and addressing those issues if department or if groups still have those issues. But I do have with me Paul Hetland, who is the city administrator in Cold Spring in my district, and I know he wants to talk a little bit about the reasons for this issue, the bill coming forward, and some of the concerns that we've had.
Welcome to the committee. Yes. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Hetland. I'm the city administrator of the city of Cold Spring. I've been there for about 2 years. Before that, I was the city clerk treasurer of Freeport, which is just north of there, home of Charlie's Cafe. And so now I went from Charlie's Cafe to beer and donuts in Cold Spring. So, it's very rural, small town kind of flavors. I represent our fire department holistically in this. We were affected indirectly as a part of some of the situation that had happened between the city of Richmond, just to our direct west, and its surrounding townships, five different townships to be exact, Munson, Wakefield, Farming, Collegeville, and Luxembourg. So those townships basically had decided that they wanted to create their own fire department. As a result, there was a number of things that were found with really a lack of real regulation to start a new fire department. I mean, really to the point where it really anybody could start their own fire department anywhere is what was found out. And many people kind of head scratched with it, going like, how does this not come up a lot sooner? How did this not, why is this taking so long in Minnesota's history for this to kind of rear its head? And part of the reason with that is that fire departments across the state, the volunteer fire department system, many of them are older than the parent cities that they're now under. So there's just been a long, long line of common sense and public safety being first and foremost into that equation and a tradition of that. What has happened in kind of the new economy, so to speak, is really a new way of being creative. And certainly all of us want government to be smarter and more efficient. The dangers of that can sometimes be just going cheap rather than thinking about public safety. So this, what has happened there is there's been a department that is formed that has very, very little experience. It really started out of nowhere, and they have about a little over 6 months of book learned experience and no other experience beyond that. And it concerns us, certainly locally, because as we've said many times, this isn't like getting a passport and jumping into Canada where you know you're leaving the protections of our great union. This is an area that all of us frequent and go into, in and out of, all the time. So it easily, most of us as Minnesotans expect a certain level of public safety, regardless of where we travel, that we know that we're going to give a certain response time if we end up in a ditch. If we have a structure fire, we know it's going to be put out under a certain amount of time, those type of things. So this really, this moratorium, working with the Office of the State Fire Marshal, has been just really a cooling off period to really get our ducks in a row to figure out what type of regulations we want to look at in this category. Is what's happened in central Minnesota a prototype of things yet to come all over the state, or is it an anomaly? And we just don't know that, Mr. Chair. So we want to go forward and bring about some practical cooling jets period and study. Thank you.
Any further discussion, Senator Goodwin?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Fischbach, or a gentleman from Cold Spring.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if the city of Cold Spring has contracts with the surrounding cities for your fire services that you produce.
Mr. Chair, yes. Members. Yes, we actually we do, and it has been a long-standing, actually good relationship we have with three of the five townships that I mentioned. We have a very, very good relationship with. So, a matter of fact, during that, one of the lines that comes up in kind of greater Minnesota is blessed are the peacemakers, and we did our best before Christmas to try to broker a deal between Richmond and these townships to do a shadowing agreement, meaning that every single call that Richmond's fire department goes out on, every single call that this new Chain of Lakes fire department go on, that they each shadow each other and learn from each other. After Christmas, they came back and said they didn't want to do that. So we did our holy best to kind of have that. We actually have a mutual aid agreement with this new fire department. So even though, you know, we're opposed to them starting, we don't think they have the experience, we still are a community at the end of the day, and we're willing to go there and help and assist them. That's not the case with every fire department in the area. Five separate fire departments, including the city of St. Cloud, have said that they will not respond to fires in that district, nor are they allowed to come into the St. Cloud district, along with four other districts, because of the inexperience jeopardizes the safety of their own firefighters.
Sir Goodwin?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, this is a little bit of protectionism legislation, I think, but this is applying to the whole state, right? Not just Cold Spring and the surrounding communities.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, yes, this applies to the whole state, but this is not, it actually will not address this specific question. We're not closing down a department. What we're trying to do is, in the future, making sure that we have something that we are, basing a new fire department on, some kind of minimum standards, so this doesn't happen again, so that we are keeping public safety at a certain level. And like I said, this isn't going to undo anything that's already happened with Cold Spring, but in Cold Spring and Richmond and the surrounding area. But we just want to make sure that when a new department is created, that there are some kind of standards that they're meeting. It's not going to necessarily even affect existing departments.
Well, one more.
Sir Goodwin.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. One more quick question then. Is there some kind of a working group that's going to develop these standards? So it doesn't look like it's part of the language here, but in this year that there's this freeze on them, is there some other way you're going to get to those regulations and so forth that you're planning that I don't see?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, we've discussed that with the State Fire Marshal's Office, and they're going to be able to, and they're coming, they will be looking and giving suggestions. They're going to come back with a report to us, and they're able to handle that without rulemaking or all kinds of things like that. They're going to come back to us with a report.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, Sarah McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like part of the bill. I like the report because it appears as though we don't know the extent of what training people are all getting, and I think there is a good public safety issue in making sure that we do have fire departments that have, minimal standards. So I support that. I'm a little nervous about the putting to referendum whether or not a fire department should be established, which is what I'm understanding. Is that what you have to do? It has to go to referendum before a fire department is established?
No. Is there official?
Is that what that says?
And Mr. Chair, we're having a brief discussion because my understanding is there part of the establishment of the new department was there was supposed to be a referendum, but then there was not. Somehow he remembers now. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hetland remembers.
Mr. What had happened was under statute, townships are supposed to go to referendum if they're going to establish a new fire department. So that's actually in statute already. Oh. If you have a joint powers authority and decide to go forward, now you do not need to go to referendum and have the people decide. And part of the issue that happened with this entire situation was that the people of the area themselves did not want this to happen. So it was really a matter of now they're waiting until the elections in the township elections to perhaps change over some of the seats to be able to change some of the things that have happened. So one of these things, it isn't an amazing anomaly throughout history in many regards, but for us, and we've talked about it before too, is that it's happened in our neighborhood and we never thought it was going to happen here, where it's our sincere intention to hopefully not have it happen anywhere else.
And Mr. Chair, I might also point out that this whole thing sunsets on January 15th, so this requirement would be gone also, this specific one. As Mr. Hetland said, there would be existing township language or statutes that would be required by the townships, but this language would disappear.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, just want to understand this so that if I have a small city, which I think most of them have joint powers agreements. Or no, we have volunteer. Let's see what all my cities do. If they wanted to establish their own fire department before 2013, then they would have. Then does this language say that they would have how they couldn't do it? I mean,
Mr.
so
Chair,
we're taking away my city's ability to establish a fire department. Is that what you're doing here,
Mr. Chair? Senator McGuire, just. Till January 15th. I mean, and so after that, then it wouldn't be. Just till 2013, so next year. So less than a year at this point, but we just wanted to slow things down so that we had the opportunity to at least take a look at these
standards
that may.
The standards and everything. If I could just,
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, I like your idea of looking at the standards and making sure that we have them. I guess I'm not sure that I think we need a moratorium. I know you don't want what's happened in your city to happen in others, and that's admirable. But I'm thinking that other cities can maybe take care of that. And if it's just only a year, I guess I just have nerve. I'm nervous to make it statewide. When it happened in your area. So I mean, I like the second part, as I said. So I support that. I'm just still nervous about the first part.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, we're really not trying to stop. We're just trying to slow things down so that we have the opportunity. If you take a look, actually, and Mr. Hetland didn't mention it, but I believe it was Channel 9 that did a investigative report on this department in particular and their ability to fight a fire. There's a video. And so if you see that, and I know that the fire department and all of its members are very well intentioned, and that is why they join a fire department. But it is difficult for them to do what they needed to do, and say the structure was a total loss. And Channel 9 even made that pointed that out. And so it's not that we are trying to stop. We're just trying to slow it down a little bit, take a breath, make sure we have some idea of what we need to do to make sure that the public safety is intact.
Sarah McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to hear from the fire marshal or from someone in the fire?
We'll be asking if there's anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the
fire. Well, and I will say just the Minnesota State Fire Department Association and the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, we've been in discussion with, and That was part of the oral amendment that we made them more comfortable. We'll be continuing. And they pointed out to me the shared services issue, so we'll make sure there's some language there. But I want to, that's not just a simple amendment, so I wanted to make sure that we worked that out and it was perfected, that if there's anything going on. But if there is somebody else who wants to testify, that would be.
Well, while we're on the subject, is there anyone else in the room who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hathlin, I've been listening to your presentation, and I believe what I heard you say is that the city of Cold Spring is opposed to other cities starting up fire departments, and that the city of Cold Spring feels that some other cities may not have, you know, the qualifications and so forth. And to me, that really, you know, if someone is going to make that kind of a call, to me it would be state fire marshal, maybe. I'm sitting here pretty unconvinced that I would be willing to impose this request from the state level to local units of government, who I believe are in a better position than we are to determine whether or not they want to have their own local fire department. So I'm very uncomfortable with your request for this moratorium. Moreover, I don't know that we have to have a moratorium in order for the state fire marshal to prepare the report that you're requesting. So I'm a little bit at a loss as to what this is even about, quite honestly.
Senator Fishbach?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I'd like to just address that a little bit. I don't think that there is a complete opposition to starting new departments. Where there's a need, absolutely. This was not, it was not, first of all, I mean, real frankly, not, it wasn't necessarily there was a need there. There was a want, and they weren't prepared to, so when we're talking specifically about that situation, they weren't prepared to go online, so to speak, when they start taking 911 calls. I don't believe that Mr. Hetlin said that he is opposed to everything. I think in this situation, they were negotiating, they were working, they were trying to make this work, not only the contracts, but they have been trying to help the new fire department with he mentioned the shadowing agreement or the shadowing in order to help them kind of with their on-the-job training, so to speak. It's a concern when the public safety becomes an issue. And they're without the minimum standards, and you are able to see what had happened in that case, public safety is at risk. And we're just trying to make sure that we slow down and take this little bit of time for moratoriums. It's not even a year. And yes, we will be dealing with the fire marshal. The fire marshal will come back with that report. And part of my vision of that would potentially be having that new fire department looked at by the fire marshal, maybe not actually approved by the fire marshal, but you know, there's things that we want to be able to work through, and having a moratorium allows us that opportunity to establish those minimum standards and decide exactly how we want to deal with this into the future.
Senator Newman?
No.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fishbach, I don't disagree with you in any respect that public safety is of paramount importance. The question that I'm raising is why the city of Cold Springs? Why don't we have the fire marshal or the various units of various fire departments from around the state at the table asking for this? Why are we at the state level going to impose our will on some local units of government like the city of Richmond or some other city? I mean, why should we do that? I'm just perplexed as to why the city of Cold Spring is here asking or making this request of us. why them as opposed to, you know, 400 or 500 other cities in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Hitler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, you bring up a very good point, and believe me, it gives me no pleasure to be here today in any way, shape, or form to tell about our story. It was more to be the I trust the cities of our great state. I also trust the townships of our great state, those local units of government. I lobby here all the time to say, get out of our business. So I'm with you all the way, Senator, on the idea of where we sit with local regulation. I think we know how to regulate ourselves best. What this is addressing is if you and I want to start a fire department. Right now, under the state of Minnesota, you and I could start a fire department. You and I shouldn't be able to start a fire. It should come from professionals. Yes, we have been working with the Office of the State Fire Marshal, and he has said, we need to have this. Now, he's here in the audience today. Certainly, you could hear from him himself, but he's been working with us to say we need to address this problem because we went through an incredible amount of pain as a city through the holidays and through this entire event. Public safety is realistically jeopardized in a place that's not in some foreign land, is in our own state. This could happen anywhere, in all due respect. So again, we don't know if this is a prototype of things yet to come or if this is just an anomaly. If it's an anomaly, then it just is something that happened within central Minnesota and it'll go away. So we're just trying to make you aware of a problem that happened in our neck of the prairie that could easily happen somewhere else. If you don't want to take action with it, that is certainly the wisdom of this committee and of this body ultimately, but we want to at least get across our story.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Fischbach, it seems like this is a mandate on local governments that could be avoided, and we are trying to avoid mandates on local governments, but certainly this makes a decision for all of the locally elected officials and the people in those areas that the state is imposing on the people in those areas. I am, too, also uncomfortable with the fact that there's a freeze, you know, moratorium. And I am also in favor of standards that I'm surprised we don't have any, and I'm in favor of that. But I don't want to impose a moratorium on. We don't know all the issues with the towns and the cities and the counties on their fire fighting, what they're doing right now to come together and coordinate their departments and so forth. So I am saying that I think the bill is premature, and perhaps you could divide it and get the parts that you really need without the freeze.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I like half of this bill, but I'm concerned about the other half. I'm wondering if the author would be open to an amendment, or if we could at least vote on it in two separate, take one part first and take the second part second, so we have a chance to vote.
Senator McGuire, like, are you suggesting splitting the bill?
Yeah.
And like, where would you split the bill?
Well, I might split it sometime between B and C. I'd ask
Senator McGuire.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one other question?
Well, Senator McGuire, maybe this will help informing that question. Council is advising me that we cannot split the bill.
Oh. Okay, because it's all in the same
section. Why don't
section.
We have council explain
Thank
that?
Thank you for.
Mr. Chair, members, if you'd like, I've been scribbling. You know, I could. I guess read. I think you could vote on an amendment that would essentially do the same thing. It just wouldn't be a division, technically. I think, and if you would give then me authority to make the necessarily kind of technical changes as well. But I think if you wanted to consider that, you would delete paragraphs A, B, and D. I don't think you'd need the effective date or the sunset anymore. And the provision wouldn't need to be codified. So essentially what that would leave you is the paragraph B, which would no longer be called paragraph B. And I think I would suggest that on line 1.19, before fire departments, you would insert newly established, just to clarify that, so you'd be left with the report if that's what you wanted.
Mr. Chair,
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we actually need a bill to do that part, to do the study? I mean, I guess I don't have any trouble asking them to do it by a certain time frame. I'm guessing they can probably do it on their own. But I don't mind asking them to have it done in a year, though, I guess. So I'm sort of answering my own question, but my guess is they could probably do this on their own, but this makes sure they do it in a timely manner. And I don't know if they're here that they want to weigh in on this, if the state fire marshal wants to talk about their intent with this or whatever. But I'd like Senator Fischbach to comment.
Senator Fischbach?
And Mr. Chair, just so that I understand, the proposal is to delete 1.10 to 1.16, and then in addition delete 1.23 to 2.4 to 2.4. Is that what I understand?
Council, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, it would also be lines 2.1 to 2.4, and then to change the head note and then not codify it. So basically what you would be left with would be essentially paragraph B of the bill, which is the report. And then I would suggest on line 1.19 you clarify that before fire department it would be newly established fire departments, which I think is consistent with the intent of the bill.
Senator Fischbach, do you understand the amendment?
Yes, I do. And I guess, yes, I'll comment on it. I'm not thrilled with it. I felt that, and the reason we had the moratorium is because I felt that we really needed to make sure that we were doing this right and that we weren't affecting, that we weren't putting public safety at issue. If that's the only way the committee will pass the bill out, then I would accept it. And since I don't sit on the committee, I don't have a vote. So, but that I am disappointed that we would pull that moratorium out. It is not a permanent moratorium. It is a very short-term moratorium. I don't know if Mr. Hetland mentioned that Senator Newman and Mr. Hetland could start a fire department and go online and start taking 911 calls whenever they decided to do that. And that was shocking to me when I found that out when I was sitting with a group in my district. And I said, well, why didn't the 911 folks stop them from taking calls? Nope. They said, we're going online, and they started taking 911 calls. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands that that's the case, that literally anyone could start a department and start taking 911 calls. And I think that it's important that we do. That's why I made the moratorium short term. And I think that it's important that we do that while we're trying to make sure we have some kind of standard.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Senator Fischbach. I think she came forward here with something very reasonable. I mean, it almost scares me to think that this could even happen. Now, I've been in public safety for many years, and I've had fire responders come to fires and car fires and whatever, but I wouldn't begin for 1 second to walk up to that truck and know how to operate that truck or even to identify that substance that might be on another truck. Or, I mean, we're talking some serious stuff here, and I think this is just a good house cleaning thing is what it is here. And it sounds like she and the fire safety professionals that are willing to work on this. I don't think this is an unusual request at all. It just scares me, the thought that somebody could start a fire department by themselves. Maybe 50 years ago, but not anymore. Not anymore with the substances we have out there. So
you know, sir,
I would.
Sir Ingebrigtsen, it kind of is reminding me of a story that there's a small town in Minnesota that instead of police protection, they hired a security firm.
Kind of, yeah.
And to do the very same work of a police officer. And I, without post-board training, maybe not even without emergency training, just to handle, you know, life-saving events, I shudder to think that we would get into, even introduce ourselves to the point of thinking that we were going to replace our law enforcement personnel with a security firm, not to mention the liability that would be triggered to that particular municipality or to those taxpayers if something went wrong in the practice of law enforcement by private individuals. So I share your concern about that. There's been reference to the state fire marshal being in the audience. Would you want to come and make comment about this? Is a rather sweeping amendment, and I would like to get your opinion on it, sir. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jerry Rosendahl, the Minnesota State Fire Marshal. With regard specifically to the section on the study, the State Fire Marshal Division currently in statute has no authority to determine standards, to authorize the formation of a department, or to review them on any kind of basis. As has been stated here, the department, a local unit of government, township, or several townships, cities, several cities, can do that.
And sir, in relation to that and the amendment, are you in favor of the amendment?
And Mr. Chair, just so that I'm explaining it right, you're talking about the moratorium, the removal of everything. This is all that would be left, is just the report back to the.
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't know that I have a position on the amended version. The moratorium is certainly your peer review and policy. Yeah. I don't see that impacting us at all. I'm just saying, in terms of the study itself, if I were to initiate that just on my own, it's like, where do you get that authority? Because I have none.
Sir Newman?
Currently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Fire Marshal just answered my question, which was going to be if we authorize you to do the study and issue a report, would it help you? And you are saying, yes, it would. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman and members, that would be much more clear on our direction, certainly.
So, Mr. Chairman, in that respect, I would think that would be a very good idea. To authorize the state fire marshal to look into the issue, which is the subject of this bill and the local fire departments and so forth. So I would be absolutely in favor of that.
Sir Newman, were you speaking in favor of the amendment or opposed to the amendment?
Speaking in favor of the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any further discussion? I hope everyone understands the amendment.
I'm not clear.
Sorry, Mr.
Chair, I'm not clear. Is the moratorium going to continue on the amendment, or is it going to stop on the amendment?
I believe it would stop, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it would be gone.
Senator Fischbach.
It would be gone. It wouldn't just stop. There would just be lines 1.17 through 1.22 left in the bill.
It basically, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it removes the establishment of a fire department, and it would simply give direction to the state fire marshal to give the legislature a report. Nothing more, nothing discussing a moratorium. Senator McGuire?
I'll just say one more thing, Mr. Chair. I mean, it's definitely not my intent that we would make anybody less safe, but I know that these are elected officials. These are city councils and mayors that are making these decisions. I think when they did decide that they were going to hire security guards, that was rescinded quickly afterwards. They decided that it wasn't such a good idea. I mean, we were not talking to, they're not going to hire just some fly-by-night organization. They should. I mean, these are local officials that we give a lot of authority to, and so it is a question of whether we're going to take away their local control or not. I certainly don't intend to help make anybody less safe, but I do think that cities and mayors, have the ability to really, make these decisions on their own. That's the reason for my amendment.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was out of the room in another committee here at the same time, so I'm just trying to follow this. The amendment just does a study, but otherwise we have a moratorium as we do a study to try to look at standards of coming up with these things. Is that the case, Mr. Chair? Senator Fischbach?
Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's the way.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, I think I'm with you on the moratorium in as much as if we can, you've shown that there was a problem, and so we're not trying to make a decision for other people. We're just trying to have people slow down if they're in that decision-making process as we come up with a report as to how they should try to organize that in a uniform way. Is that what I'm understanding, Senator Fischbach?
Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that is correct. And I'd also like to point out that's been a little lost in some of the discussion is that we do give the local unit of government the opportunity to, if they choose to override the moratorium, they have their election that would be provided for in D. So we are the purpose is to slow down, but they are given that opportunity in paragraph D.
Senator Jackmeyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I think that I'm against the I'm against the amendment then because I do think if we already have somebody that has had an issue, that is the impetus for the legislation, and I think to slow people down and giving them another way out of that is not a bad thing if we already have one issue of something that sounds like drastically went wrong. So I'm not in favor of the amendment.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for the fire chief. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that one of your jobs was to inspect local fire departments. It's not.
Mr. Chair and members, no, that is not true.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, this is for the fire marshal also. How many fire departments come online in a typical year?
Mr. Chair and members, approximately 6 or 7 have come online in maybe the last 10 or 15 years. We're actually seeing a reduction in the number of fire departments. We currently have 790 in Minnesota with about 21,000 firefighters, 90% of which are volunteer. And if I could, just to tag a little bit on Senator Fischbach's comment before about shared services, through a study done last year with a number of under a number of grants provided through the fire safety account, we have 8 communities that are studying ways to share services and even potentially one at reducing the number of fire departments and going with a smaller number of fire departments or 4 going into 1 potentially for better efficiencies, et cetera.
And Mr. Chair, that is why we would be addressing that in a more extensive amendment in the shared services.
Senator Harrington.
Okay, and my second question for the fire marshal is how long would it take to create the standards for what does it take to be a modern, effective, safe fire department in terms of the research and or is there already a body of knowledge out there that exists that would give you some direction?
Mr. Chair and members, there are currently 2 different national standards. National Fire Protection Association has 2 standards, one essentially for all career departments and one for part-time paid on-call departments. And my intention, if this study is ordered, obviously that we would utilize that and then use the Fire Services of Minnesota, the League of Cities, Association of Townships, Insurance Federation as a group that would review those national standards and add, delete, and come up with a study. And I certainly think we can do that by the January date that's in the bill.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Hearing none, Senator McGuire moves her amendment. I'm assuming everyone understands that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hands. 3, 4, 5. And those opposed, raise your hands. 4. The amendment is adopted. Senator Fischbach, any further testimony?
No, I don't think so. I, Mr. Chair, I think we've got a study bill.
Senator Ingberson, would you
I would so move
that Senate File 2148 as amended be recommended to pass and be moved to local government committee?
Yes, thank you.
No. Senator Fischbach?
Oh, I guess, Mr. Chair, since, they're saying that since you've got it, the
no
bill,
referendum
it doesn't need
and
to go there.
The other parts of the bill are no longer in here. this bill can go directly to the floor. So Senator Ingerritsen renews his motion that Senate File 2148 as amended be recommended to pass and move directly to the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, thank you very much. Senator Robley. What I can tell is there's
maybe one fire department. Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
It's
good, to be here today. I haven't been in front of this committee yet this year. I have Senate File 2121, and it comes to us as a follow-up to a recommendation from the Legislative Auditor's Office after their evaluation on fiscal notes. And actually, I do have an amendment that I would like somebody to offer so we could put this in the shape that I need it. It will make it a lot less controversial and quicker to review.
Yeah. Senator McGuire, would you help out Senator Roebling with her author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, if she says that we'll do what she said, I would move that. I guess I should look at the bill first, but I'm guessing is it a bill that
a recommendation from the
legislature? Is it non-controversial?
I can't say for sure.
It will make it more non-controversial. Yeah, I'll move it. I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
Senator McGuire moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire.
Senator Roebling, I just have to warn you that since we have a dominant minority presence on the committee, you have to really sell your heart out to get this bill through.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have two minority member co-authors on the bill. Also, we have all authors who are on the commission for the Office of the Legislative Auditor, because we like to follow up on their recommendations. It doesn't always happen, but this time I remember to pick this one up because it had to do with finance and finance notes. And or fiscal notes, and in the report that came out maybe not even a month ago, some of you saw it, the one on fiscal notes, one of the recommendations was this: the legislature should amend Minnesota Statutes 2011, Chapter 13, to authorize that requests for fiscal notes on unintroduced bills and the resulting fiscal notes be classified as not public data, and MMB should work with the legislative leaders to develop a strategy for implementing this. And the reason this is important is because they want to see the fiscal note process. They're recommending that we try and figure out a way to get these notes out there to authors as quickly as possible. And there's authors that who may hesitate to request a fiscal note early before they're ready to introduce the bill because they don't want others to know what they're working on. And so it would be an unofficial fiscal note, actually. And right now there's a little bit of a process where they deal with these, but the typical procedure, which Michelle Weber could explain, puts it into a system that hundreds of people have access to. And so instantly you don't know if that's a secure system or not. And so this would probably not, it wouldn't involve all fiscal notes. It would only, with the amendment, it would only involve those that the author requests that it be kept private or classified until the bill is introduced. And then, of course, it would be made public. At that point, of course, they probably would also want a very official fiscal note to take to the committees with. But this would help an author determine if they even want to introduce a bill. Because sometimes you have a grand idea, but you find out it has a grand price tag. And you know it's not going to be something that will fly in the current climate, or you're thinking, I don't know how we can fund this. And you might say, oh, well, that's the end of that. We might as well drop that idea. But until you ask for that, you really don't know. And so that's why we're asking that just be classified until the author is ready to release it. And we're thinking that there may only be 10, 12 requests like that a year. It would probably be something that's of some significance. Most authors, if it's a minor program or minor change, may not even care if it goes through the regular system. But we have a problem doing it in the regular system and keeping it classified because their system is so old, and that was also noted by the legislative auditor, that it would have to be reprogrammed in a major way, which would give me a big fiscal note on this bill. In fact, it says that it might cost $1.5 million to put in a new system if we changed it, not even knowing if the old system could be reprogrammed because it has so many quirks and needs right now that they might have to bring in a new system and it would cost a lot of money. So I'm trying to avoid my own fiscal note here and say, let's just do it when the author requests that it be classified. And as I said, we don't expect many of those in any given year.
Sir Roebling, this bill, if passed, would go to the Finance Committee. Is that correct?
I believe it will, yes.
So we'll have that discussion about the fiscal note impact on that. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the idea. I think it sounds really good. I'm thinking if I was going to have a bill, you know, be drafted, that I would assume that the fiscal note might be private. But now you're telling me that I might have to request it, though. I mean, I like your bill, and I know that you're trying to limit it. But how will we all know that we have to request that it be kept private because or non-public? Because otherwise, I would think that until it's been introduced, it wouldn't be public. I'm glad we're making a clarification about that because I wasn't correct in that assumption, but I sort of want to be correct in that assumption. So sure. How will we let members know that they have to say, I want this to be non-public until introduced? How's that for
I see
long,
Mr. Turner
a long question?
Knows a
Mr.
lot
Turner,
about this.
Can you add to the conversation?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, I've made in the last 5 years, I've made maybe 3 requests like this.
Oh, okay.
I mean, this just does not happen very often. And it usually happens for something big. The last one I did was for a sex offender study. And we wanted to get a handle on the costs, but we didn't have a bill yet, but we had to deal with the costs beforehand. And we needed the Department of Finance to help us. And so it doesn't happen very often. And now, right now, Nobody spills the beans on fiscal notes, at least the fiscal analysts don't.
Right.
The problem is that there are a lot of people with access to their system, so if somebody wanted to go in and cause mischief, they could. But Senator Roebling, is what I said just makes sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair,
it could be considered unclassified at any point now. The request to keep it out of the system occasionally happen where someone might ask an agency, for example, and not put it into the system. It's kind of an informal process, but those could all, because we've never classified them as classified, they in many ways could be considered public data.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, wouldn't it work maybe better and make people a little more at ease if it said that they were classified unless the author stated otherwise? They were considered classified unless the author said, I don't care if it's private data or not. Wouldn't that kind of make sense? Because then it would be easier for us to, like Senator McGuire said, that we always considered that private data, and now we find out that it isn't. So that would make it easier, I think, on everybody. I'm not suggesting an amendment to your bill right now, but maybe you can think about that when we get into finance, and then we can just assume it's private unless we say it's not, the authors.
Mr. Chair, there might be a problem just because of the way the system is set up, and if Ms. Weber could address that, it would be
good. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Weber, and I am a team leader at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm responsible for overseeing the fiscal note process and managing the fiscal note system that's used. Senator Goodwin, I did talk with Senator Roebling this morning about the bill language. Initially, the bill in its initial form did have it classified as private unless the author wanted to make it public information. The problem is that there are several of these requests that authors do use the formal fiscal note system for the process of getting a fiscal estimate on the proposed language that they're considering introducing. And the system is very old. It would take significant reprogramming for us to make those notes private. And what we have heard is that not all of the unintroduced bills does an author have concern about other people seeing that information. And so what this does, the amendment that Senator Roebling has put together, is it avoids us having to use the fiscal note system for the purposes of these unofficial fiscal notes and avoids the increased costs that would be associated with the bill as a result of having to reprogram that system. And it still would allow authors and fiscal analysts to use the system for unofficial fiscal notes if the author isn't concerned about the information being private.
And, Mr. Chair, when it gets into that fiscal note system, there are literally hundreds of people who have access to that. And so even if you classified it as private, I don't know that you would consider that very private with all of the access to it. So that's one of the reasons we're just going to carve out an exception. And typically, Senator Goodwin, you work with a fiscal analyst, and they would know if you were talking with them, and they often put in the requests, actually, for the fiscal notes, and they had any reason to believe that you might want to keep it private. As long as we educated the fiscal analysts, they should be able to tell a senator or a House member that there is an option for them, that it wouldn't have to be out there in the public if it's something that wasn't ready to be revealed to the public.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Senator Newman moves that Senate File 2121 be recommended to pass
amended.
As amended. Be recommended to pass and be moved to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, members.
I've been told that Senator Benson will make her return trip to the Judiciary Committee. We'll have to wait a bit. Thanks for being patient, members, with all of this.
Well, witnesses in there.
Sir Marty.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, I noticed the witness list is a couple lines longer than the length of the bill that I'm going to testify.
Strange things happen in the Judiciary Committee. Senator Marty, you're aware of that. I know that. Due to the lateness or the prolonged session in the Senate, we are pushing the 5 o'clock hour. And so that's why we're a little late, and we're waiting for that Senator Benson.
Oh, it's getting longer.
Senator Benson, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I apologize. We were working on energy issues. I have today... Senate File 1749. It is repealing some legislation from 3 years ago, I believe it was, that limited access to DNR information. That information had been largely available to the public, and making all of that data private has created some significant issues, and so I think we should begin with hearing some testimony on the impact that this repeal or that the privacy of this data has had on some of our testifiers. And Mr. Chair, do you have a list of testifiers?
Yes, I do. Senator Benson, do you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, but I thought perhaps some testimony would be in order first so that the committee could understand the importance of the amendment and its appropriateness.
Is Mr. Mark Anfinson and John Kennard here? And if they are here, could they please approach the table?
And Mr. Chair, I also have Mr. Don Dunn.
Dan Patrick Dunn and Sheila Deo, if they could be ready for testimony. Mr. Kennard.
Yes. Thank you for having me. My name is John Kindrick. I'm a constituent of Michelle Benson, but I'm also an employee of Northern Reporting Service. We're a licensed private detective agency in the state of Minnesota. We've operated continuously since 1985. We only investigate insurance fraud, and for many years we had access to DNR information. When we receive a potentially fraudulent claim from the insurance company, law firm, or even governmental agency, one of the things that we used to do was to pull DNR information. It's fairly critical information given the state that we live in. What we look for when we investigate for insurance fraud is activity outside of somebody's scope of disability. If somebody says that they don't have the ability to sit more than 10 minutes or they can't return to a light-duty job because their condition doesn't allow them to perform any physical activities, DNR information can point us in one direction or another. If somebody says that they haven't hunted or fished for the last 4 years, this will confirm it for us. By the time it reaches my desk, it's gone through a claim handler, a supervisor, a claim manager, and perhaps even a vice president of an insurance department. Our job is to determine whether that claim or provide information to allow them to make a decision whether the claim is valid or not. Not only does it indicate possible activity, but it can also help us develop leads during our investigation. And that's why we would ask that you allow licensed private investigative companies, people with a purpose who have experience in keeping information private from the public, allow us access to that information.
Mr. Kennard, currently do you have access to this data list?
We do not. In fact, we work for a few state agencies, and our understanding is that law enforcement and state agencies are allowed access to that information, but the DNR doesn't recognize that. If we are working for, say, the state of Minnesota, we're on the vendor list. If we request DNR records on somebody that we're investigating for the state, we're not able to get that information. The request has to come directly from the state or the League of Minnesota Cities or Minnesota's Counties and Trust, whoever we're working for. We have to go through them, even though we are their representative and they have hired us to investigate the claim.
Are there any other ways you can gain information on owners of this type of property?
What we can't get for instance, snowmobile trail stickers. We can't find out if they're fishing, if they're hunting, if they're trapping, if they've purchased a pheasant hunting license. One of the reasons that we like this information is it tells us where somebody has purchased their past fishing or hunting licenses, which oftentimes will allow us to determine whether or not somebody has a cabin in a given area, and it helps us canvas county courthouses looking for property. There are just a number of different ways that we use this information to confirm a person's activity level.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Anfinson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mark Anfinson. I am the longtime attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association and the state's news media generally, and we are here to support the bill as introduced in the strongest possible terms. We think that the bill will restore Minnesota law to the state that it was in for many decades prior to 2008. Because of a fluke, the intersection of federal law with data the DNR collected in 2008, the DNR was required to restrict public access to this database, the licensing database, for a brief period of time. By 2009, that interference with the federal law was eliminated. And so what this bill would now do would be to put Minnesota law back to where it was prior to 2008, which was as follows. Licensing data collected by the DNR would generally be public. There's a good reason licensing data collected by the DNR should be public. If you consider what the licenses are issued for, they're issued for things like hunting and operating boats and operating high-powered recreational vehicles on state and private property. And the DNR issues licenses and permits for that kind of activity probably for a pretty good reason. And that is because all of those activities, operating using guns and other equipment to go hunting or operating high-powered boats on Minnesota lakes and waters or operating high-powered recreational vehicles in Minnesota on Minnesota property is dangerous activity potentially. And so the state should at some level regulate it. The short version of my testimony is that there were many, many public benefits over the decades of allowing public access to this information. There was never, ever a single documented problem or issue caused by public access to this data. And so our position is if the benefits far outweigh the detriments, and if the historic policy of the state of Minnesota is that government records are presumptively public, unless there's a good reason to close off public access, then this bill seems to be a no-brainer. It should go forward in its original form.
Thank you, Mr. Anfinson. Next on the testifying list, we've got a Mr. John Kennard.
No,
I'm sorry. Mr. Dunn?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, I'm just curious because I got the sense from Mr. Anfinson that he likes the original bill, not the amended version, and I'm curious, when are we going to learn what the difference is?
Well, and Mr. Chair and
Senator Benson.
Senator Marty, I wanted to have a little bit of input. For the benefit of the committee, there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes discussion. The amendment fundamentally changes the nature, and so now we've had a reason for repealing the statute, reason for leaving it open. Let's hear a little bit more testimony for making the data available, and then the committee can make a final educated decision on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Dunn. I'm one of the owners of the R&D agency. We're also a licensed investigative firm here in Minnesota based in Burnsville. We've been in business for 20 years now. As Mr. Kennard mentioned, my firm also does a high volume of insurance fraud investigations, and I think he's mentioned pretty clearly why some of that information that we used to be able to get is so valuable to establishing a profile for some of these individuals that are under investigation for suspected insurance fraud. We also perform other types of investigations where this data is necessary, such as asset searches. For example, someone's got a judgment against them and our client is trying to determine if they have assets. We look at property records and other things, snowmobiles, boats, ATVs, Those are certainly assets that have value that could factor into the asset search arena. So many of this information, my understanding was that it was available up until the language was slipped into an omnibus bill, and it wasn't really discussed. It was certainly not brought to the attention of our industry or other industries that were affected by this, and it was pretty much just slipped into law as a part of that omnibus bill. I would certainly encourage the committee to reverse that decision to once again make this information available to the public.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Benson, is there a fiscal note on this? It seems to me that that would take at least some DNR staff to respond to the request for information.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I have overlooked requesting the fiscal note for this particular piece of legislation, so I cannot answer that question. The DNR has not stepped forward to oppose this. I think it's something that they do in the ordinary course of, or had done in the ordinary course of their work, but that is a step that I have overlooked.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lemmer.
Also, Senator Goodwin, this bill has just been requested by Environment to hear also.
Pardon me, by who?
This bill will be requested to be heard by the Environment Committee.
Oh.
So they will give it further scrutiny.
Okay. Thank you.
And maybe we can get a little better idea then. Mr. Chair, I had a question. Mr. Dunn.
Senator Lemmer.
Well, I suppose I should get into the amendment first, but we have one more person that wishes to speak. Senator Benson, would you want to hear that individual now or have that person a part of the discussion on the A1 amendment?
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Lemmer, if you would like to move the A1 amendment, you have put work into this, yep. And I'm happy to move it as an author, but if you'd like to move it as your amendment, you can do that at your will.
Mr. Chair, I wish to move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me explain it a little bit.
Please proceed.
The bill itself, 1749, is a little broader approach to handling this type of data. The A1 amendment would be a little bit more specific. On the A1 amendment, if you go down to the paragraphs 1, 2, 3, and 4, it recognizes a government entity for natural resource management purposes, 2, for the use in the normal course of a business so that legitimate businesses or their agents, employees, or contractors can verify personal information on a item-by-item or a person-by-person basis. It's not to be used to collect the whole list or the whole data list that's in the file in this appropriate agency. Also, number 3, in connection with any civil, criminal, administrative, or arbitration proceeding in any court or agency. And number 4, of course, is to provide notice to the owners of any towed or impounded vehicle. It's sometimes difficult to determine who owns a boat that's been sitting alongside a freeway. Because all you have is either a license plate or you have the code name on the side of the boat itself, the license code. Sometimes you don't even have a trailer. I've driven down the road and the boat has slipped off the trailer and it's sitting there on the side of the freeway. And so you don't even have a license on the trailer itself to follow. The reason why I am presenting it in this fashion is we have had a long discussion on data privacy of public files. How much access do we give individuals for it, and how do we do so if we're going to put limitations on it for either commercial purposes or just to have anybody just peruse the file? We were very concerned a few years ago about the stalking incidences with cars. People might see an attractive person in another car, and they take a license plate number and go over to the DMV to get that identity or the address. That certainly could happen if you were skilled in knowing that a list was available to a general perusal by anyone on a boat. Let's take, for example, if an attractive person drove by in a speedboat and waved at somebody on shore, maybe that person might get a really a compounded feeling that that individual wasn't just being friendly but was being a little more suggestive. They might, in fact, take a number down and follow it up to find out where that person lived. I want to be very cautious about how we approach this. But at the same time, I want to recognize the legitimate business interests to go after people that really need to be identified to the property that they own. We talked about examples of people who had storage facilities. They didn't make their payments. They have a boat in someone's storage garage, and there's no way to identify the owner to the boat. This, I think, would solve that problem. Senator Benson, what was the other example that you and I talked about?
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer. In the case of a bankruptcy, when they were trying account for assets, if people had not fully disclosed their assets.
Right.
Senator Limmer.
And as a result of a bankruptcy investigation, we, too, were hoping that this amendment would give that opportunity to open the door a little bit, focus on the individual property and hence the individual property owner without having a full-scale approach to grabbing a whole list of all those that own 14 to 16-foot aluminum craft fishing boats. And so, or for that matter, the stocking issue once again.
Mr.
So
Chair?
I'm hoping that the issue that the private detectives are bringing up may be addressed in the normal course of business opportunity on these lines. And I was wondering if I could get their reaction from it. I don't know if you've seen the amendment, sir, but
I just had a chance to glance at it earlier.
Mr. Dunn.
He's referring to Section 2. And Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson.
I believe we did have another private investigator who was available. Perhaps he wanted to come up, review the amendment, and comment.
The only other individual I have on here is Sheila Deo from the DNR. If there's another someone else that you want to have come forward and testify,
Why don't we
allow Mr. Dunn to respond to Senator Limmer's question first, however?
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair. In a quick review of this language, it does appear that it would address some of the issues specific to the asset search portion of the investigation. I think Section 3 may address, for the most part, the insurance fraud matters that we deal with are under Department of Labor and Industry. So I don't know specifically if administrative proceeding would relate to that. I also just want to mention that the private data we're talking about, first of all, when we open a case, we get the private data so we can start the background search, Social Security numbers and dates of birth. Those things aren't in the DNR, certainly not Social Security numbers. I'm not sure that dates of birth are even in there, just full names and addresses, I believe, are the private information, if you want to call it that, that would be contained in there. So to answer your question, yes, I believe number two would address this. Obviously, I think my industry would prefer more of a broad repeal of this so that it's available not just to us, but to other professionals that find a need for it. But if having a restricted access to that information would allow investigative agencies like ours to access license and registration information, then I would support this.
Senator Lemon.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn, what other organizations would you want to have accessible to this information?
Well, I think attorneys. Certainly, the insurance adjusters, perhaps. I think Mr. Atkinson represents the newspaper industry, and I think certainly they have a reasonable reason to access this information. You brought up the storage facilities, and I think apartment owners would fall into the same category if they have boats or trailers and things like that left on their property. I think the danger in restricting the information is that we simply can't address with a quick thought on the matter all the other agencies or entities that might have a legitimate need for the information.
Well, Mr. Dunn and members, if you look on paragraph 2, where it states, for use in the normal course of business by a legitimate business, I know we're talking of attorneys, but even them, even they are considered legitimate businesses. And so would it be any of its agents. So I'm hoping that would have covered it. But
Senator Benson, do you have any comments that you want to make on the A1 amendment? I do have two senators. I have a couple questions. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Limmer and I have consulted on this a great deal. I lean more broadly to letting the information be available, but respect his experience with data privacy and the need to put some boundaries on it. It is not my will that an average citizen could walk into the DNR and obtain broad amounts of information for an undefined purpose. And the DNR did have a process prior to the repeal of this law that seemed reasonable. And this is reflective of that process, even though it wasn't in statute before.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, perhaps for Senator Limmer. And your amendment, or maybe in current law, is the data allowed for child support enforcement? For example, for assets that, you know, one of the non-custodial parents may have before the divorce procedure or during the divorce procedure even, so that they can get data on the assets?
Can counsel weigh in on that issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, under the current law, a private person wouldn't have access. A private person would not have access under current law, but a government entity could. So if you had the child support agency doing enforcement, they might be able to get it, but a private person would not under current law.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer or
Senator Goodwin.
My brain isn't working. once again. So what I'm really curious about is oftentimes in a divorce, there are hidden assets that the custodial parent is not able to get a judgment on for child support. And I think that's another important place where the attorneys in a divorce case would be able to have access to that data if there's a question about the assets for child support purposes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, if I could bring your attention to line 21, paragraph 3. It says, for use in connection with any civil, criminal, administrative, or arbitration proceedings in any court or agency, or before any self-regulatory body, including service of process, investigation in anticipation of litigation, and the execution or enforcement of judgments and orders, or pursuant to a court order, provided that the requester provides a copy of the order. So I think that would be covered.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, my recollection, and I'm forgetting this some over the years, but the driver's license data for automobiles and so on, is that not also available to virtually everyone?
Senator Marty, and your question is to?
To Mr. Anfinson or Senator Benson or whomever.
Senator Benson?
I can too.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Anfinson?
I'll let the testifier speak to that.
Mr. Anfinson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, the answer is that the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which is a federal law passed in 1999 and which was the law that goofed up the DNR's ability to make its database public in 2008, has 14 exceptions. some quite narrow, the tow truck driver exception, as you see in Senator Limmer's proposed amendment, others very broad. For example, there's a very broad exemption that includes access by the news media. So it's not everybody, but it's a very long list of entities and individuals who do get access.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Marty.
Prior to that federal law, it was driver's license data and so on was available to everyone except, again, for domestic violence or somebody who had reason for security in which they could, like home data and other stuff, residential address and so on, could be hidden. Is that what it was prior to that federal law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, that's correct. Minnesota law had what is generally referred to as an opt-out provision, which allowed people who had reasonable fear that the data would be abused, they could request that it be kept private, and it was.
And so,
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, this bill is the amendment proposal would be a partial what the federal law has for the driver's license and other stuff. This would be not as many exceptions, news media and others wouldn't. The bill as introduced would be much closer to what we had for everything else. Is that a fair statement? And then also with that, if we did the bill as originally introduced, does that give somebody the privacy if they are being stalked or something like that where they can protect their data, or is there no protection whatsoever if the bill passes as is?
Mr. Amphenson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, on your first question, the amendment proposed by Senator Limmer would impose more rigid and narrower restrictions on any type of access than is currently the law for driver's license and motor vehicle registration data. The bill in its introduced form, the bill before the committee in its introduced form, does not incorporate a provision allowing individuals who are concerned about release of their data to have it classified as private. But having said that, it would be very simple to add an amendment right out of the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, for example, to accomplish that purpose.
Mr. Chairman, that's the direction I think we ought to be heading. I kind of like the openness. I mean, I remember a number of years ago discussing the issue of whether driver's license data ought to be available for marketing purposes, which it was. And now everything's available for marketing purposes and so on. Anything you do, they can market to you on. But I guess I think it's important to have that kind of protection. But, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I wonder if yours is tighter than it needs to be for that, and I kind of would like the original bill with that extra protection in it.
Is there any further discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, excuse me, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 1749 as amended?
Oh.
I noticed that we do have one more testifier. Am I correct on that, Senator Benson?
Mr. Senator Benson. Chair, I was only informed of three testifiers, but if someone else is here to speak, certainly.
You're right.
Is Ms. Dale? Yes, please.
She's been sitting patiently all day long.
She's a very patient lady.
We don't want to shortchange her.
Thank you. Mr.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Sheila Dale, Department of Natural Resources. I'm our data practices compliance official.
And I'm going to ask you to please pull your mic forward.
Is
speak right into it because it's hard to hear.
All right. Better?
Very good.
Okay. The Department of Natural Resources recognizes the need for businesses to have access to this data. But on the other hand, we also realize that citizens have a concern about personal information being released. So therefore, we are looking to the legislature to provide direction to us regarding the classification of the data. What we ask is that the data be classified in a way so that it's manageable for our staff, so they are you know, not having to make decisions about whether data is public or not public, and you know, having a risk element in making decisions about the classification.
Thank you. Any members have any questions for Ms. Dale? Seeing none, is there any other questions? Senator Benson? I assume it is your desire at this point to move your bill, and it's going to environment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
No, I understand. But that's where it's going, is to environment, Senator
Yes,
Benson?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File Number 1749 as amended be recommended to pass and move to Environment Committee.
To all those in favor of Senator Limmer's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion is adopted. You're on your way to Environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
There being no further business before this committee, we stand adjourned.
Timing is good. I think I only missed a couple, so.